Support for Alaska Public Media On Demand comes from Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, maintaining and operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977. More at alyeskapipeline.com.
Hello, and welcome to Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Colorectal cancer is now the second leading cause of cancer-related death in the United States. And what's especially concerning is that rates are rising in adults under the age of 50. Many people have no symptoms in the early stages, which means cancer is often discovered later when it's harder to treat. And yet, this is one of the few cancers we can often prevent through screening that can detect and remove precancerous changes before they ever become cancer. Here in Alaska, the impact is especially important to talk about. Colorectal cancer disproportionately affects Alaska Native communities, and access to screening and support can vary widely depending on where you live. These are not just statistics. They represent our neighbors, our families, and our communities. Today, we're bringing together both lived experience and medical expertise to help us better understand what's changing, what to watch for, and what we can do to protect our health. Joining us today is Ms. Julie Wrigley, a colorectal cancer survivor who was diagnosed at age 40 and now serves as a passionate advocate for early screening and patient support. She is the co-chair of PALTOWN Development Foundation, the parent entity for ColonTown, a national patient support organization that works to connect colorectal cancer patients and caregivers with information, community, and hope. We're also joined by Dr. Praveen Roy, a board-certified gastroenterologist with Internal Medicine Associates in Anchorage, Alaska. Dr. Roy has extensive experience in general gastroenterology and advanced endoscopy, completing his fellowship at Georgetown University and the NIH. He's contributed more than 150 publications in this field. His work focuses on improving detection and deepening our understanding of gastrointestinal disease, including colorectal cancer. Ms. Wrigley and Dr. Roy, welcome to Line One.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you
for having us.
Yes, thank you both. Okay, let's get into it. Let's start with you, Dr. Roy. And I want to start by getting to know you better and what drew you into medicine and specifically into the field of gastroenterology.
Well, thank you for having me here. I got into medicine, I'll say, because of two folks. One was my dad. He was he taught chemistry in a college, and he let me come play in his chemistry lab as a young kid. So that got me interested in science and trying to understand things. And I always want to know how the human body worked. So mm-hmm. I decided to go into medicine to understand it better. And once I got into medicine, one of my mentors during my residency program, he basically told me, I think you're suited for gastroenterology. I wanted to be a critical care physician, but he felt I would be happier in gastroenterology.
And for those who may not be as familiar with gastroenterology, can you walk us through what is this field? What kind of conditions or concerns are you treating?
So gastroenterology is a branch of medicine where we are focused on the digestive system. And that includes anywhere from the esophagus all the way down to the rectum. It also involves dealing with the pancreas, the liver, the bile duct. Encompasses all these systems.
Okay. Yeah, the whole digestive system. Yeah. Well, Ms. Wrigley, you've lived through this and had care from a gastroenterologist and lived through this experience in a real way. Can you share a bit about yourself and your experience?
I'd be happy to. I'll try to keep this brief, but my experience was interesting in the sense that I did everything I could to be a healthy person my whole life. I was a vegetarian. I've always been an exerciser. I've always had a healthy weight. I jokingly say I've run marathons for Alaskans. I've participated multiple times in the Golden Nugget, and ooh, I've even climbed Kilimanjaro. I spent my 30s tired, but dismissed all of my symptoms in my whole body because I was raising three young children. And anyone who has any children, or maybe just working and raising children, or just working, it can be really hard to pay attention to your health. So when I started having more non-specific digestive issues, that's how I describe as a woman or as a human with our midsections have so many different things going on in there. I would just say my stomach hurt. And it led me to seek the input of my GI doctor. And I went to Dr. Roy's partner, Dr. Steve Engel, and I was 39.
Now, how long had you been experiencing symptoms?
I would say definitely from the beginning of my 30s, quite a while. But as I mentioned, it's so hard to know what really is going on. I just thought I jokingly say, well, I was lactose intolerant maybe, or maybe I shouldn't eat gluten, or I'm having too many, I don't know, salty chips, or eating too many nuggets off of my children's plates. I don't know. I didn't know what it was. So all of the symptoms I was experiencing were pretty easily dismissed for a middle-aged woman of reproductive years.
Now, had you been seeing primary care or gastroenterology during this time?
No, I hadn't. Well, yes, I'd seen primary care, but not a GI doctor. In fact, I'm very lucky. I've had a good relationship with my primary care providers. It's always been, as a planner, as someone who wanted to be healthy, I was very good about going in to get my annual checkups of all kinds and making sure that I was paying attention. But you know, I'm also a people pleaser, and I had a busy life, so I wanted to not be a problem and just get in and get the basics checked. And I wasn't very descriptive about my own, you know, stomach issues. It just seemed like something everyone I know at that time had going on. So at some point, one of my primary care providers said, well, Julie, maybe you should go see a GI doctor because I eventually spoke up about my stomach issues. And she suggested, Dr. Koval suggested that I go see a GI doctor. And I was dismissive of that because I really didn't have I didn't have time. I didn't want to make time, honestly, for another doctor's appointment. But I went because I do believe if you see a doctor who you are putting in charge of your own health, it's really important to respect their suggestions. And if I disagreed, I should probably look for another provider. So I followed her directions, and that's what led me to Dr. Engel. I do like to point out, if you don't mind, that before I went to see Dr. Engel, I did something that I think is really uncomfortable for most of us. And I don't know why I did it, but I'm so glad I did. And that was, I called up both of my parents, which I'm so lucky to be able to have done, and asked them very specifically. I said, I'm going to see a GI doctor for the first time, and I've never asked you, but do you have any anything that you want to pass on, any of your own health history that I should know as I go see this GI doctor? And that's actually, in fact, what led me to a conversation with Dr. Engel, where he recommended that when I turn 50, ha ha ha, someday in 10 years, I should really have a colonoscopy. He said this year as a baseline, because my father had polyps. Sorry, I'm telling the story a little disjointed, but my father had polyps, and so he recommended I had it earlier than 50 at the age of 40. And that's when I said, isn't that what old people, you know, mm-hmm. now that I'm 52, isn't that what old people do when they're 50? And he said, someday, Julie, when I'm 40, when I'm, you know, we made jokes about us being old. Of course, I'm older than Dr. Engel, but he suggested I get the baseline colonoscopy at 40, which ended up saving my life.
Right. And you may not have gotten that suggestion if you hadn't seen the GI doctor, I think it's important to point out that you were having symptoms before the general screening age. Now, the screening age is younger now. We'll let Dr. Roy tell us about that. But yes, mm-hmm. at the time, you were having these symptoms 10 years before where they recommended your first screening at that point.
Yeah.
So that's, yeah, very important to keep in mind and a bit scary to be having those. You mentioned your father had polyps. Was there, he didn't have colorectal cancer, but he had polyps. Is that correct?
Correct. Okay. My father shared with me that he had been screened at the age of 50 with the regular, well, what were the prescribed the age at the time for
right.
for colorectal cancer, and he had had a history of polyps, which was and again, Dr. Roy is the expert on this part, but that led Dr. Engel to suggest to me to begin my screenings at the age of 40. Just the polyps. They were never cancerous for my dad, thank goodness. They were in fact just precancerous or, you know, easily removed for my father, but not for me.
Yes. Well, Dr. Roy, can you tell us a bit about the importance of family history, and also how important is it to know about polyps, especially if they're benign polyps?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's very important to know about the family history, whether it's history of polyps or history of colon cancer. So, you know, I'm impressed that Julie asked the, you know, her family. A lot of people don't know their family history. And that plays a big role. So if there's a family history of colon cancer, we start earlier. We will start at age 40 if the person, family member, had colon cancer in their 50s or 60s. If they had it at a younger age, let's say the family member had colon cancer at age of 45, then we'll subtract 10 years. And then we'll start all the relatives at 35. Similarly with polyps too, we start earlier.
Okay. And so even if these polyps are non-cancerous, you're going to start earlier for screening family members?
Yes. So certain polyps, mainly adenomatous polyps or villous polyps, we will start earlier. Yeah. If they're hypoplastic, then no. But adenomatous, yes.
So that's even more information that would be important to know, the type of polyp, which, you know, they may not know. It may take some work to look into. And is that because these polyps have more of a potential to become malignant if not removed?
Yes. So we think that colon cancer is a slow process. Mm-hmm. It goes from normal lining to polyps to cancer. So that gives us the opportunity to go and remove the polyps and prevent cancer down the road. So if there's a family history of colon polyps in the family, we feel that the first degree blood relatives are at a higher risk of getting it, and that is an opportunity to go and look for polyps, remove them, and prevent cancer down the road.
Okay. And Ms. Wrigley, I'm just curious about what are some of the moments that stand out to you now, looking back, either challenges or sources of strength during your journey of treating colorectal cancer?
I guess one thing what stands out, it was a really scary experience in the sense, like I mentioned, I thought I was doing everything right. I mean, we live in a state where so many Alaskans prioritize getting outside. We are constantly reminded to take care of ourselves in different ways because of the wonderful landscape that we live in. And so many of us are so good at that. But it's, you know, one of those, I guess, what a wonderful community to be with when you are faced with a challenge like this. And what stands out to me is use that community, I guess. My friends and family showed up like crazy to take care of us. My kids were young. Well, my youngest son doesn't even remember, which is pretty funny. he was in third grade, and his memory of mom being sick was nothing compared to the other kids. So,
yeah, that would be very difficult. And a blessing for that one, that he could just be your source of, you know, continue to have the all about me kind of feeling as kids should have, right? Well, you've taken this experience, though, and you've really turned it outward to help others with your work in Colintown. Can you tell us about that and the community that's there?
I'd love to. I will say that being in Alaska, when you have this kind of diagnosis, is tough in the sense, because of our isolation. You know, colon cancer, colorectal cancer is not something that is often talked about, or you don't see it advertised at the hockey game. People don't like to talk about this part of our body. And anyone who knows me knows that I am more than happy to talk to anyone about their colon health. A friend just said something like, you know, Julie, what I love is that you love my colon almost as much as you love your own. And it's true. I just want everyone to take care of their colon health. So what I've done with my experience is reached out to bring more support back to Alaskans. I've looked for ways to make the knowledge empower us with the knowledge of getting screened, as well as if you happen to fall into the club that no one wants to join, the cancer club, how to find that support. You know, and if it's not local, then where is it? And so I've been on the board of the I'll just call it Colintown. Paltown is the parent organization, but I thought it was funny. It started out as a Facebook group in 2013 when I joined it, and now we do peer-to-peer support. It's international. Not only there's all these funny named neighborhoods where patients and caregivers connect with each other. So it's not just the patients, but also the caregivers. It's free. There's also a free Colintown University, which is a go-to hub for learning about colorectal cancer. And if you know, there's a I was just diagnosed, what do I do now page, which is just amazing. We also have doc talks, people from all over the country, oncologists, researchers, surgeons talking about the latest things so that the patients can be empowered. And then we also have a second opinion project, because stage four is often something. When someone is diagnosed with stage four, you're really looking for every opportunity to extend your life. So second opinions often become part of that. So we're an organization that I think is really accessible for Alaskans. Of course, that's where my heart is, but people all over the country. And it just makes it feel like you're not alone, because you're not alone in this colorectal cancer journey. But finding the resources used to be a lot more difficult, at least in 2013 when I was diagnosed. It was close to impossible. So,
would you share with us which stage you were diagnosed in?
Sure. Yeah, I was stage 3B, which stage 3. And so I had, I guess I failed to mention, I had over 14 inches of my colon removed, in addition to 62 lymph nodes. And I had a tumor in my descending colon that was the size of a golf ball. So it was pretty significant. And I endured, 12 chemotherapy treatments. And in the middle of all of that, there was, of course, sometimes, you know, bodies are what bodies are. I had some complications that I overcame, and had to take a break from the chemotherapy. But it was quite an aggressive treatment plan that has led to, you know, years of recovery, but also continued health for myself. And that's I'm still here 12 years later. It was all worth it.
And how long was that treatment journey?
Well, for me, it ended up being almost 9 months. Generally, those 12 treatments, which I think, again, Dr. Roy can speak to this, but the protocol when I had treatment was the 12 treatments of what they call full FOX, which is three different chemotherapy drugs, and it should take 6 months. But my body had a couple things to say about that, and I had a complication that required hospitalization, and so I just drug it out as long as possible, I guess. but it all was resolved in a 9 month period. Well, the chemo was the administration of the chemotherapy. The recovery from the chemotherapy, I would say, went on another year at least.
I wonder, Dr. Roy, if you could speak to how she went through this journey. Obviously, you may not know personally, but in general, is her age something that was on her side while she was going through these treatments?
Yes, definitely. I think being young, and also she was in a very good physical shape, physically active, probably, you know, that definitely helped with her undergoing chemotherapy and surgery and all that, yes.
Because I know that you are thinking, why do I have this cancer when I am taking care of myself and doing all of the things that you're supposed to do and eating right? But then on the other hand, I'm thinking because you did those things, that probably did help you in terms of the success of your treatment. So although you joined the club you did not want to join, hopefully, I think you set yourself up well, perhaps, for health. How is your health now?
My health now is great overall. I there are long-lasting, anyone who's endured chemotherapy knows there are things that never go away. There's the mental scars as well as the physical scars, and I unfortunately had a bout of still occasionally reoccurring neuropathy, but that's because of the oxaliplatin in the full FOX chemotherapy I received. Every day is a blessing to me.
Yes.
So
thank you for sharing that. Yes. And it's, you know, with any difficult situation, it's hard to relive it over and over. But what you're sharing is so helpful to people, so helpful to hear. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I wonder if you can talk about some of your symptoms, some of the unspecific symptoms you had.
Sure. In retrospect, I can identify more of what was going on as a symptom, but I just wanted to explain the non-specific because I do think that's so common with women. I mean, I'm not a man, so I don't know, but I assume with men as well. As a woman, we have so many things going on in our bellies that you don't know what it is. But now, you know, it was bloating. You hear that all the time, but I was significantly bloated. There's a change in the shape of your stools that you may or may not catch on to because you know, how much time do you spend in the restroom evaluating that kind of thing? I did not have blood in my stool, which is a symptom. I hear a lot of my colorectal cancer friends had that as a symptom. I did not. But those two things, the excessive bloating. I could also, I hate saying this, I did feel something in my abdomen on the side, which now I know was was the tumor. But I just thought, I'm a woman with an ovary, and that must be what I'm feeling. And so it's this. What's the colorectal cancer version of see something, say something, or feel something, say something? It's what I'd like to encourage people to do, is if you feel off, whatever that means for you, no one knows your body like you do, you know, ask the question of an independent third party, you know, your primary care provider, what they think, because it might be something that one question could save your life.
Right. Absolutely. Thank you, Ms. Wrigley. Nobody knows your body like you do. I say that all the time. And so if there is a change or a difference or something uncomfortable, yes, see something, feel something, say something. I love that. We do have to take our first break. And when we come back, we're going to tackle those symptoms and talk about screening and prevention. Okay? You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection. After this short break, we will continue our discussion of colorectal cancer with patient advocate Julie Wrigley and expert Dr. Praveen Roy as Line One continues statewide. Welcome back to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined today by Ms. Julie Wrigley, a colorectal cancer survivor and advocate, and Dr. Praveen Roy, a gastroenterologist and experienced researcher with Internal Medicine Associates in Anchorage. In this next segment, we're focusing on screening and prevention of colorectal cancer. Well, Dr. Roy, we're going to be moving into screening, but before that, we're hearing more about changes in colorectal cancer, especially in younger adults or earlier onset. What are some of the factors you think may be contributing to this shift to being diagnosed at earlier ages?
I think there's several factors at play. We don't exactly know one main factor, but several factors are thought to be playing a role. It's felt that over the last 50 years or so, we have seen a gradual increase, more pronounced in the last three or four decades. We are seeing younger and younger patients coming with colon cancer. Colon cancer used to be thought of as a disease of the old. It's no more a disease of the old. Any age group can get it, and we are seeing it all over the world. So it's not just high-income countries. We think diet, change in diet might play a role. We think that less physically active, sedentary lifestyle might play a role. There's also thoughts that with the change in diet, the gut microbiome has changed. We think introduction of plastics, microplastics in our diet might play a role by acting through, again, the gut microbiome. Ultra-processed foods also are thought to play a role. So there's several factors that we think are contributing.
Well, those are hot topics right now. The gut microbiome, microplastics, ultra-processed food, yes. What are we learning about the gut microbiome? I know we're hearing a lot about the gut-brain connection. How is the gut microbiome important in colorectal cancer prevention?
So we have microbiome all over the body, and we have it, in the genital urinary tract. We have it in our respiratory tract. We have it in the gut. Even in the gut, there are different types at different places. The one in the mouth are different from the one in the small intestine and the one in the colon. We have more information about the one in the colon. We're still learning about the small intestine. Now, when we say microbiome, there are different types of organisms present. You have bacteria, you have fungus, you have viruses. Most places have focused on bacteria. Now, when we mention these organisms, they don't work in isolation. We are realizing they also work together. So there are some viruses called bacteriophages or prophages. They will get inside a bacteria and take over. And so basically they're working together. So we are learning more and more about it. We are realizing that they're good bacteria and not very good bacteria. And we need the bacteria to function. We think that in the gut microbiome, we have about a few trillions of bacteria, and they make good substances that help us fight inflammation, help us fight cancer. Then there are the not-so-good bacteria, which disrupt the lining of the gut, they break the barrier, increase the permeability of the gut, which exposes our bodies to external factors, toxins.
So things are leaking out of the gut?
They're coming in.
Okay.
Like coming in. So so some of the not-so-good bacteria also make toxins. And they also, some of them will suppress the immune system because our body is designed to fight changes where the changes might progress towards a cancer. So it will suppress some of the immune suppressor cells. So we've got good bacteria and not so good bacteria. We need the bacteria to live. And of course, we need the other ones too, the viruses, the fungi, and the other organisms present. The goal is to try and have a healthy environment.
So this makes me think about antibiotic use and those who use antibiotics recurrently over and over for infections. And so I'm imagining this is going to really destroy some of the good bacteria, because it doesn't just each antibiotic may be specific for a specific group, but in that they can take care of getting rid of the good bacteria, or if you're having antifungals, getting rid of our good fungus as well as the bad. Are we seeing, as we start to recognize use of antibiotics may not be the best, overuse, I guess I should say, because we need antibiotics, but overuse, are the rates of overuse of antibiotics decreasing, and then are we seeing a change in cancer rates?
So you bring up a good point on antibiotics. So that we can get antibiotics through prescriptions, and also comes in through diet, because we have animals that get antibiotics. So the medical community has made a conscious effort to decrease antibiotic use and make it as appropriate as possible. But I'm not too sure about the food industry. I think that's still coming in. If we look at the trend of the early onset colon cancer, earlier you had asked me what factors play a role. I think the antibiotic use also plays a role. If we look at when it started, probably started in the 1960s. And that's when we saw an uptick of, or we feel people born at that time who got exposed to the antibiotics and the plastics and the ultra-processed food altogether probably led to higher risk of colon cancer when they got older.
Interesting. I have another question, and this may be a little self-serving, actually, about the immune system. And you talked about decrease of the immune system and increasing rates of cancer. Is that what you were saying?
Yeah, what I said was it's more like a local microenvironment at play. So anytime there's changes in cells, the body fights it by sending immune cells to fight that local area. But these bacteria will produce chemicals that will suppress those cells and push them away. So then the tumor, unfortunately, then grows.
Are there any issues with steroid use, whether oral steroids or inhaled steroids, disrupting this cycle?
No, I don't think steroids play a role. We feel that this is a very slow process that happens over maybe years. Because when you have a change in gut biome, and if it's not healthy, we call it dysbiosis. The state of dysbiosis probably exists for years. And as you know, changes in cells, which lead to cancer-like changes and then full cancer, takes years to develop.
Mm-hmm. And then when it comes to food, in Ms. Rickley's case, were you vegetarian, Ms. Rickley?
Yes, I was, for 10 years prior to diagnosis.
Wow. So 10 years, because we're thinking about the animal products and dairy products. So the animal products where they're giving animals the antibiotics, and then we are getting these increased antibiotics or other substances that we're getting through the food products. And how big of a role is that playing in the development of cancer?
So these are still being studied. We feel that most likely works through the gut microbiome again. It's interesting in Ms. Wrigley's case, she was very physically active, which should decrease the risk of colon cancer. She was very conscious about her diet, eating more plant-based products, which again decreases the risk. If you historically look at countries that are more, which ingest more fiber, they have lower rates of colon cancer, especially I grew up in West Africa. They had one of the lowest rates of colon cancer in the world. India also has had lowest rates of colon cancer. Unfortunately, it's not the case anymore because of change in diet. So all those factors, I think, were plus for her. But we think that, yes, with the introduction of antibiotics, that there is a change in the microbiome where probably the good bacteria are getting killed and they're not flourishing, and the bad bacteria probably are, you know, proliferating more and making toxins or breaking the gut barrier and leading to changes that lead to colon cancer over several years.
Okay. And what about the role of hereditary cancer screening? Are we seeing an increase in people who are having screening if they've had family members that have had colon cancer?
Yes, yeah, so the family history is very important, and genetics plays a role. So I think in Ms. Wrigley's case, I think that could have been the role that led to her getting cancer at a young age. We are seeing there's more awareness among the patients. People are asking that questions more at home, like she did. So I'm really impressed that she went and, you know, asked her family members. That's really helpful for us because that is an important information we use in our decision making, when to start a colonoscopy, and how often to do it. So when we're looking at colon cancer risk, we talk about average risk and high risk. So if someone has a family history of colon cancer, they're no longer considered average risk. They're considered high risk. And for high-risk individuals, we only offer colonoscopy from a preventive standpoint. The other tests do not, are not used. We also do it a lot more frequently. If someone has a family history of colon cancer, and I do a colonoscopy and it's normal, then most likely we'll bring them back at 5 years and not 10 years. And also there are different types of family histories. Sometimes there are genetic syndromes running the families. So it's important to know that, like Lynch syndrome. And that also plays a big role in making recommendations.
What are some of the recommendations for screening aside from colonoscopy for a low-risk individual?
So for an average risk person, we will start at 45 if they don't have any symptoms. And there we have several options available. The most common one you hear about is colonoscopy. The others are, there are some stool-based tests also. So you, I'm sure, have heard about the FIT test, which looks for occult blood or markers of blood in the stool. There's also Cologuard, which is a FIT test plus looking for DNA changes. So I see that as a more enhanced FIT test in a way. So those are the three most commonly ones that are currently used. There's also something called flexible slit biopsy, which we don't use that often nowadays. It is the shorter form of colonoscopy. And there's also a CAT scan of the colon called CT colonography. Currently, I don't think we have that in Alaska, but that's also an option.
Who would get that option over a colonoscopy?
Well, we found that CT colonography is not very popular because you still have to drink some prep. You go to the CAT scan room and they put you're wide awake and they put a tube in the lower end of the colon and they put some air in to inflate the colon so they can see. And so even when I worked in the lower 48, it was not very popular.
Yeah, but that doesn't sound popular.
But some people prefer that over the tests.
Why would they prefer that?
Some people may not want a colonoscopy because they're scared about the procedure. And if it's normal, then generally you say we come back in 5 years, every 5 years. But the most common ones are colonoscopy or the stool-based tests.
Well, what are you doing most of in your practice? Obviously, you do a lot of colonoscopies, but are you recommending these lower risk screening tests as well, if someone absolutely doesn't have a family history and they don't have symptoms, or do you still prefer a colonoscopy?
So, patient choice matters a lot. So I generally leave it to the patient to decide. I also feel that the best test is the test that gets done. So the goal is to get it done, get some tests done. Currently, the percentage of patients who are eligible for tests and who do it is probably 50% or less. We want the goal to be close to 80%. That is the goal at the national level. So we push that, you know, the notion that best test is the test that gets done. So whatever the patients are comfortable with, we'll do it. Colonoscopy is a good test. It gives us a chance to find polyps and cut it out, so which prevents cancer. But it does take time. It is invasive in the sense that someone is taking a tube and taking a look in the colon. So it's, you know, some people get concerned and don't want that test. So the other options are there. The stool tests, you can do it at home. You don't have to take any time off. But one should be ready that if the stool tests are positive, the next step is colonoscopy. Unfortunately, I found when I was working in the lower 48, a good number of patients, even with a positive FIT test or Cologuard test, were not coming for a colonoscopy.
Because they were afraid of doing that test?
Yes, they were afraid. They had concerns about colonoscopy, and they had probably read wrong stuff on Google and did not want to come for it.
Dr. Google.
Yes.
Well, that's surprising, Dr. Roy. I did not know that 50% of people that should be or are eligible due to age, I guess, are not actually having colonoscopy. I just didn't realize it. I know I deal with cervical cancer, and in the cervical cancer world, our rates of cervical cancer have decreased, you know, dramatically because of the screening. And, you know, nobody really wants to have their pap smear, but we have high buy-in, I guess, to getting that pap smear, and thus very low rates. So if we could get that, imagine the changes that we could make.
Oh, yes, yes. So that's why the push is to encourage them to do whatever test they're comfortable with. And the uptake depends on the age group. So if you look at age 45 to 49, and that's the age we talk about early onset cancer, and there's one group that can easily get screened. The insurance pays for it. They look at it as a preventive test. The uptake is about 20 to 30%. If you look at the national numbers. Now, if you look at the age group 65 to 75, almost 70-80% show up for a colonoscopy. So it varies on the age group we're dealing with.
So we need to have more outreach at these younger ages.
Yes.
And more talk about these signs and the symptoms, right? Okay. Well, we're going to take another break, and then we're going to talk more about the signs and the symptoms when we return. We'll continue our discussion on colorectal cancer when we return. You're listening to Line One, Your Health Connection on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Line One. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. I'm joined by Ms. Julie Wrigley, a colorectal cancer survivor and advocate, and Dr. Praveen Roy, a gastroenterologist with Internal Medicine Associates in Anchorage. In this final segment, we plan to discuss colorectal cancer symptoms to watch for. Well, Dr. Roy, we had a question that came in, a caller came in over the break. And this is an interesting question. They want to know why prostate exams and colonoscopies can't be done at the same time. I guess to save money, to save time. This sounds interesting. To me, I'm thinking, okay, prostate exams, your primary care does, or urologist, but you know, you're down there. What can you say about this?
So that's a good question. You're correct, we're down there and we can do the exam. The concern is that, well, with prostate exam, you need it every year. And sometimes I'm seeing the patients once every 5 years or once every 10 years. The other problem is expertise. I don't think I have the right expertise for prostate cancer. And I'm concerned that I might miss some. I'm not used to feeling the prostate for prostate cancer. The primary care or the urologists are better experts in it than I am. So I would encourage the patients to discuss it with their gastroenterologist before the exam. And, you know, they could discuss it further after the procedure.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, financially, I'm thinking as well, you're doing your colonoscopies in a sort of surgical suite or in even a surgery center. And so to have that exam done by having somebody else come in to do the exam, because that would be my next question. Okay, we'll have them come and do it. That would actually be even more expensive to have an exam that's typically done in the office, but then have it done in the surgical suite.
Yes.
So, but I understand if you're already kind of under, a little sedated, yes, please do all of the uncomfortable things at the same time. But that's the answer for that. We should probably then let's talk about these symptoms that Ms. Rickley spoke about. What are some of the key symptoms where someone should be concerned and should prompt a visit to discuss, you know, being screened for cancer?
So I guess your question is, in the younger folks, what will prompt a colonoscopy evaluation?
Probably,
okay,
yes.
Okay. So in the younger folks who don't qualify for screening, let's say, who don't have a family history and they start having symptoms below the age of 45, or we are then, you know, looking at more as a diagnostic evaluation. The symptoms that that they should speak up and talk to the providers about is rectal bleeding. A lot of times you might see frank blood, or you might see maroon blood, or you might see black blood. Any of those should prompt evaluation. Change in bowel habits. By that I mean, suddenly you're having diarrhea that you did not have before, or you're having constipation that you didn't have before. So if you see a change in the pattern, then that's definitely
concern.
Change in caliber of the stool, like Ms. Wrigley mentioned, suddenly stools get thin and it is persistent, then we are concerned. If you're losing weight, you're having belly pain, so all this should prompt further evaluation.
Bloating, which bloating occurs in so many different disease processes and non-disease processes, so that's a very non-specific point. I think she mentioned the bloating. Is there a time where bloating should take you in, or is it that, hey, bloating is a change for you, have it evaluated?
So bloating is a tough one, as you mentioned, is a common symptom. So if bloating in combination with other symptoms, definitely we'll jump in. But bloating alone, that not every physician will jump to further evaluation with colonoscopy.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Okay, we have a caller. We have Elaine from Anchorage that has a question for us. Ms. Elaine, welcome to Line 1.
Thank you. My question is there an age at which colonoscopies are no longer recommended? I have an older sister in her 80s, and her physician suggested she not bother getting a colonoscopy because the GI tract is more friable as you get older, and there's more risk of puncture. And is that true?
Great question. Dr. Roy, can you take that?
Yes, so at a certain age, we definitely like to stop doing the preventive examinations because, we're looking at the risks and benefits. So after a certain age, I'll say the risks outweigh the benefits. The whole goal is to prevent cancer down the road. We also look at other medical conditions that the person might have, such as heart problems or lung problems. If they are playing a big role or causing significant problems, then probably looking for colon cancer is not that important. So if you look at the U.S. Preventive Task Force, if you see what recommendations they have made, they say that till age of 75, we should, proceed with routine preventive colonoscopy. Between 75 and 85, it's case-by-case basis. So you have to evaluate the scenario and just make sure that the benefits outweigh the risks. So the risk of perforation doesn't really go up as we get older, but the risk of complications in general goes up. So you have risk of anesthesia. The prep also gets very difficult for the patients. And if they have other medical issues, that could also prop up during the procedure, such as, they have heart problems,
or lung problems that could get in the way of anesthesia or the procedure.
That's a great way of putting it. I always think about needing screening if you would do something about it. So I'm thinking if you would treat it and you're healthy enough to withstand treatment, then you should be screened. But I like that we should talk to people about risks and benefits. And yes, of course, if the risks are outweighing the benefit for a study, then we have to take pause in that. And so what about what she mentioned about being friable? Bleeding easily, you know, of not being as strong.
Yeah, so if the medications might play a role, so if they are on Plavix or aspirin, then the risk of bleeding is definitely higher. And the other challenge is sometimes you have to stop these drugs for the procedure. They're probably taking this to prevent a stroke or heart attack. So anytime we stop those, now we're taking a risk of a stroke or heart attack. So that also comes into our calculation, that is it worth taking that risk for a preventive colonoscopy?
Right. And I think it bears mentioning again that, so it goes to 75, your routine screening. From 75 to 85, they're not saying not to do screening, but it should be case by case. So evaluating each person and deciding for them what that risk-benefit scenario is.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Ms. Rickley, having gone through this experience, how do you think about prevention at this point for yourself and for others? And screening?
Absolutely. Screening is probably the most important thing I could recommend to anyone who gets me in a room and starts talking about their health. I have this saying, you know, we have, our bodies have a lot of parts that have a lot of screenings available. There's some that are more talked about than others. So I believe in, and I encourage everyone I know to screen all your body parts if you can, as appropriate. It could save your life. And if I could just take this moment to say that colonoscopies are not scary. It's a misconception, or I would say, having had countless numbers of them myself and taken friends, and actually my children, all three of them have had them for various reasons, and my husband, but they're not scary. They're the prep is not worse than a mild stomach flu. It is not that bad. And the nap, if you choose to use anesthesia at a colonoscopy, is the best nap you're ever going to have. And I would just encourage everyone to take care of your bodies because your life depends on it. So if you could, so please, preventative health is available to us. Please take care of yourselves.
Yes, thank you for saying that. I did have my first colonoscopy at 45, and I also thought that was a very nice nap. It was too short. I said they were very, very efficient, and you know, you think about some of the things just being awkward, but you know, for gastroenterologists, they are used to doing these procedures multiple times a day and make it very comfortable. So I was really impressed with the care that was received during that time.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Well, we're hearing so much more about environmental exposures and the processed foods and the microplastics. Can you tell us more about how that fits into either increased rates or even prevention?
Yes, so the field was still learning about it. There was a recent study that came out in one of the journals this year. They looked at, it's called the Nurses Health Study from Boston. They looked at folks who were consuming a lot of ultra-processed food. And these are all nurses, and they were monitored over the years, and they found that those who ate higher amounts of ultra-processed food had about 45% higher risk of getting colon polyps.
Really? Wow.
Yes. So.
Well, it looks like we've come to the end of our program. Time always moves so quickly when we are having these meaningful conversations. So thank you both. Thank you to Ms. Julie Rigley. Thank you to Dr. Praveen Roy for sharing their perspectives and their expertise with us. Thank you to our audio engineer, Crystal Hyde, and our producer, Emily Mesner. You can find more information on this and previous programs at alaskapublic.org. We always welcome your thoughts and your suggestions. You can reach us at line1@alaskapublic.org. This has been Line One, Your Health Connection. I'm your host, Dr. Jillian Woodruff. Thank you.
Line One is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and not necessarily those of Alaska Public Media, this station, or its underwriters. Learn more about Line One and listen online at alaskapublic.org. This is Alaska Public Media.